sacred to them, with steel and fire destroying the great white trees wherever they found them, and hacking out their carved faces. The great hill called High Heart was especially holy to the first men, as it had been to the children of the forest before them, crowned by a grove of giant weirwoods, ancient as any that had been seen in the Seven Kingdoms. High Heart was still the abode of the children and their greenseers. When the Andal King Eric, the Kinslayer, surrounded the hill, the children emerged to defend it, calling down clouds of ravens and armies of wolves, or so the legend tells us. Yet neither tooth nor talon was a match for the steel axes of the Andals, who slaughtered the green seers, the beasts, and the first men alike, and raised, beside the High Heart, a hill of corpses half again as high, or so the singers would have us believe. True history suggests otherwise, insisting that the children had abandoned the riverlands long before the Andals crossed the narrow sea. But however it happened, the grove was destroyed. Today only stumps remain where once the weirwood stood.
Though Erig's name is one of the blackest in the ancient histories, one may wonder if he ever existed in truth. Archmaester Peristan has suggested that Erig might, in fact, be a corruption of an Andal title and not a name at all. Peristan goes further in his A Consideration on History, suggesting this nameless Andal chieftain had cut down the trees at the behest of a rival of the River King, who used the Andals as sellswords.
The penultimate and greatest of the River Kings to stand before the Andals was Tristopher the Fourth of House Mud, the Hammer of Justice, who ruled from a great castle called Oldstones, on a hill by the banks of the Blue Fork. The singers tell us he fought 100 battles against the invaders and won 99 of them, only to fall in the hundreds, when he rode to war against an alliance of 7 Andal kings. Yet it seems convenient that there are 7 kings in the songs. Likely this is another tale concocted by the Septons as a lesson in piety. Before the Muds, there had been other kings near as powerful. The Fishers are said in some chronicles to have been the first and oldest line of river kings. In others they are accounted the Second Dynasty, and the fragmentary Annals of the Rivers, from the ancient Septree at Peasdale, suggest they were third. The Blackwoods and Brackens both claim to have ruled the riverlands at various times during the Age of Heroes. The Mud succeeded in unifying more of the riverlands than any of their predecessors, but their reign was not to last. The Hammer of Justice was succeeded by his son, Tristopher the Fifth, or Tristopher the Last, who proved unable to stem the Andal tide, and failed even to hold his own people together. The Andal kings who brought down Oldstones and slew Tristopher the Last intermarried with the remaining nobility of the first men and butchered those who would not bend the knee. A quarrelsome, warlike folk, the Andals divided up the riverlands amongst themselves. The blood of the last kings of the first men had scarce dried before their Andal conquerors began to war each upon the others for dominance. Though many a lord would name himself King of the Rivers and Hills, or King of the Trident, centuries would pass before any of these petty monarchs held sway over enough of the riverlands to be worthy of these titles. The first of the Andal kings to bring all the riverlands under his sway was a bastard born of a tryst between two ancient enemies, the Blackwoods and the Brackens. As a boy, he was Benedict Rivers, despised by all, but he grew to be the greatest warrior of his age, Sir Benedict the Bold. His prowess in battle won him the support of both his mother's house and his father's, and soon other river lords bent their knees to him as well. It required more than 30 years for Benedict to throw down the last of the petty kings of the Trident. Only when the last had yielded did he don a crown himself. As king, he became known as Benedict the Just, a name that pleased him so much that he set aside his bastard surname and took Justman as the name of his house. As wise as he was stern, he reigned for 23 years, extending his domains as far as Maidenpool and the Nick. His son, another Benedict, reigned for 60 years, and added Duskendale, Rusby, and the mouth of the Blackwater to the river realm. House Justman ruled the Riverlands for close on 3 centuries, the chronicles tell us. Their line was ended when Curridd Hor, king of the Iron Islands, murdered the sons of King Bernar the Second while they were held captive in Pike. Their father did not long survive them, provoked into a hopeless war for vengeance against the Ironborn. Another period of anarchy and bloodshed followed. The realm that Benedict the Bold had knitted together was torn asunder once again, and 100 years of conflict saw petty kings from the houses Blackwood, Bracken, Vance, Malister, and Charlton contending with one another for supremacy. The unlikely victor in these struggles was Lord Torrance Teague, an adventurer of uncertain birth who seized a fortune in gold in a daring attack upon the Westerlands and used the wealth to bring sellswords across the narrow sea in great numbers. Seasoned warriors all, their blades proved the difference, and Teague was crowned King of the Trident at Maidenpool after 6 long years of war. It is said, however, that neither King Torrance nor his heirs ever sat securely on their thrones. The Teagues were so little loved by those they ruled that they were forced to keep the sons and daughters of all the great houses of the Trident at their court as hostages in case of treason. Even so, the fourth Teague monarch, King Theo the Saddlesore, spent his entire reign a horse, leading his knights from one rebellion to the next, whilst hanging hostages from every tree. As with the first men, the dynasties of the Andal River Kings oft proved short-lived, for enemies surrounded their realms on every side. Iron men from the isles raided their coasts to the west, while pirates from the Stepstones and Three Sisters did the same to the east. Westmen rode down from the hills across the Red Fork to pillage and conquer, and the wild hill tribes emerged from the mountains of the moon to burn, plunder, and carry off women. From the southwest, the lords of the Reach sent iron columns of knights across the Blackwater whenever it pleased them. To the southeast lay the domains of the Storm Kings, ever eager for gold and glory. In all the long history of the Trident, under hundreds of rulers, there was hardly ever a time when the river folk were not at war with at least one of their neighbours. Sometimes they were forced to fight upon 2 or even 3 fronts at once. Worse, few of the river kings ever enjoyed the full support of his own lord's bannerman. Memories of ancient wrongs and bygone betrayals were not oft put aside by the lords of the Trident, whose enmities ran as deep as the rivers that watered their lands. Time and time again, one or more of these river lords would join with some invader against their own king. Indeed, in some cases, it was these very lords who brought the outsiders into the riverlands, offering them lands or gold or daughters for their help against familiar foes. Many a river king was toppled by such alliances, and each new battle only served to set the stage for another to follow. With hindsight, it is plain to see that it was only a matter of time until one of the invaders chose to stay and claim the riverlands for his own. The first to do so was the Storm King, Arlan III, Durindon. Humphrey of House Teague was king of the rivers and the hills in those days. A pious ruler, he founded many septs and mother houses across the riverlands and attempted to repress the worship of the old gods within his realm. This led Raventree to rise against him, for the Blackwoods had never accepted the Seven. The Vances of Otranta and the Tollys of Riverrund joined them in rebellion. King Humphrey and his loyalists, supported by the Swords and Stars of the Faith Militant, were on the point of crushing them when Lord Roderick Blackwood sent to Storm's End for aid. His lordship was tied to House Dorridon by marriage, as King Arlen had taken one of Lord Roderick's daughters to wife. Waiting her by the old rites beneath the great dead weirwood in Raventree's Godswood. Arlen III was quick to respond. Calling all his banners, the Storm King led a great host across the Blackwater Rush, smashing King Humphrey and his loyalists in a series of bloody battles and lifting the siege of Raventree. Roderick Blackwood and Elston Tully both fell in the fighting, along with Lords Bracken, Derry, Smallwood, and both Lords Vance. King Humphrey, his brother and champion Sir Damon, and his sons Humphrey, Hollis, and Tyler, all perished in the campaign's final battle. A bloody affray fought beneath two hills called the Mother's Teats, on land claimed by both the Blackwoods and the Brackens. King Humphrey was the first to die that day, it is written. His heir, Prince Humphrey, took up his crown and sword, but died a short time later, whereupon the second son, Hollis, did the same, only to be killed in turn. And so it went, the bloody crown of the last River King passing from son to son, and finally to King Humphrey's brother, all within the space of a single afternoon. By the time the sun went down, House Teague had been entirely extinguished, along with the kingdom of rivers and hills. The fight in which they died has hereafter been known as the Battle of Six Kings, in honour of Arlen III, the Storm King, and the five River Kings his Stormlanders slew, some of whom reigned for minutes, not even hours. Certain letters found by maesters in service at Storm's End and Raventree Hall in later centuries suggest that Arlen III did not intend to claim the Riverlands for himself when he marched north, but rather planned to restore the crown to House Blackwood, in the person of his good father, Lord Roderick. His lordship's death in battle twisted those plans awry, however, for the heir to Raventree was a boy of 8, and the Storm King neither liked nor trusted Lord Blackwood's surviving brothers. It appears that King Arlen briefly considered crowning his good daughter, Shearer, Roderick Blackwood's eldest child, with his own son ruling at her side. But the River Lord spoke out against being ruled by a woman, and his grace decided to add the Riverlands to his own domains. And so they would remain for more than 3 centuries, though the River Lords rose against Storm's End at least once each generation. A dozen pretenders from as many houses would adopt the style of River King or King of the Trident and vow to throw off the yoke of the Stormlanders. Some even succeeded, for a fortnight, a moon's turn, even a year, but their thrones were built on mud and sand, and in the end a fresh host would march from Storm's End to topple them and hang the men who presumed to sit upon them. Thus ended the brief, inglorious reigns of Lucifer Justman, Lucifer the Liar, Mark Mudd, the Mad Bard, Lord Robert Vance, Lord Peter Mallister, Lady Jane Nutt, the Bastard King Sir Adam Rivers, the Peasant King Pate of Fairmarket, and Sir Lyman Fisher, Knight of Oldstones, along with a dozen more. When Storm's End's grasp upon the Riverlands was finally shattered, it was no River Lord who broke it, but a rival conqueror from beyond the lands of the Trident, Harwen Hoare, called the Hard Hand, King of the Iron Islands. Crossing Ironman's Bay, with 100 longships, Harwen's force landed 40 leagues south of Seagard and marched inland to the Blue Fork, carrying their ships with them on their shoulders in a feat the singers of the Isles still celebrate. As the Ironborn moved up and down the rivers, reaving and raiding as they pleased, the river lords fell back before them or took shelter in their castles, unwilling to risk battle in the name of a king many of them reviled. Those who did take up arms were savagely punished. A bold young knight named Samwell Rivers, a natural son of Tommen Tolly, lord of Riverrun, assembled a small host and met King Harwin on the Tumblestone, but his line shattered when the hard hand charged. Hundreds drowned attempting to flee. Rivers himself was hacked in two, so that half his body might be delivered to each of his parents. Lord Tully abandoned Riverrun without a fight, fleeing with all his strength to join the host gathering at Raventree Hall under Lady Agnes Blackwood and her sons. But when Lady Agnes advanced upon the Ironborn, her belligerent neighbour, Lord Lothar Bracken, fell upon her rear with all his strength and put her men to flight. Lady Agnes herself and two of her sons were captured and delivered to King Harwin, who forced the mother to watch as he strangled her boys with his bare hands. Yet Lady Agnes did not weep, if the tales are true. "I have other sons," she told the King of the Iron Isles. "Raventree shall endure long after you and yours are cast down and destroyed. Your line shall end in blood and fire." Likely this prophetic speech is a later invention, added to the tale by some singer or storyteller. What we do know is that Harwin Hardhand was so impressed by his captive's defiance that he offered to spare her life and take her as a salt wife. "I would sooner have your sword inside me than your cock," Lady Agnes replied. Harwin Hardhand granted her wish. The rout of Lady Blackwood's host spelled the end of the Riverlord's resistance to the Ironborn, but not the end of the fighting. For word of the invasion had finally reached King Eric Durrandon at distant Storm's End. Assembling a mighty host, the Storm King raced north to meet the foe. So eager was this young king to come to grips with the Iron Man that he soon outpaced his own baggage train. A grievous mistake, as Eric learned when he crossed the Blackwater and found every castle shot against him, and neither food nor fodder to be found, only burning towns and blackened fields. Many of the Riverlords had joined the Iron Men by then, under the command of the Lords Goodbrook, Page, and Vipen. They slipped across the Blackwater and fell upon the slow-moving baggage train before it reached the river, putting King Eric's rear guard to flight and seizing his supplies. Thus it was a stumbling, starving host of Stormlanders who finally faced Harwin Hardhand at Fairmarket, where Lothar Bracken, Theo Charlton, and a score of other river lords had joined him. King Eric had half again as many fighters as his foes, but his men were weary from days of marching, confused and dispirited, and their king soon showed himself to be both headstrong and indecisive. When battle was joined, the result was a shattering defeat for the Stormlanders. Eric himself escaped the carnage, but two of his brothers died in the fighting, and the rule of Storm's End over the lands of the Trident came to a sudden, bloody end. Across the riverlands, it is said, many small folk rejoiced to hear the tidings, whilst their lords emboldened rose against the few small garrisons of Stormlanders that remained scattered across the region, casting them out or putting them to the sword. The bells of Stony Sept rang for a day and a night, the chroniclers tell us, and singers and begging brothers went from town to town to proclaim that the men of the Trident were their own masters once again. These celebrations proved short-lived, however. It has been said, particularly about Stonehenge, that Lord Lothar Bracken had made common cause with the Ironborn in the belief that the hard hand would make him king once the Stormlanders had been expelled. But there is no written evidence that supports this claim. It seems unlikely. Harwin Hoare was not the sort of man to give away crowns, just as Arlan III Durrandon had done 3 centuries earlier. Harwin claimed the Riverlands for himself. Those river lords who had fought beside him had done naught but exchange one master for another, and their new master was harsher, crueler, and more exacting than the old one. Lothar Bracken himself was amongst the first to learn that lesson when he sought to rise against the hard hand half a year later. Only a few minor lords rallied to his banners, and King Harwin crushed him utterly, sacking, then slighting Stonehenge and hanging Lord Bracken from a crow cage for the best part of a year whilst he slowly starved to death. In later life, King Eric twice attempted to cross the Blackwater and take back what he had lost, but without success. His eldest son and successor, King Arlan V, tried as well, and died in the attempt. Harwin Hardhand would rule the Riverlands until his own death. He died abed at the age of 64, whilst taking carnal pleasure of one of his many salt wives. And his son and grandson would succeed him each in turn, continuing the brutal domination of the Ironborn over the peoples of the Trident. Harwin's grandson, King Harren the Black, spent most of his life in the Riverlands, building the gigantic fortress that would bear his name, returning to the Iron Islands only infrequently. Such was the state of affairs when Aegon the Conqueror came ashore and put an end to Harren and House Hoare. The rule of the Ironborn over the Riverlands ended in the holocaust that engulfed Harrenhal. Afterwards, Aegon named Edmund Tully of River Run, first of the River Lords to declare for the Targaryens the Lord Paramount of the Trident, reducing the other River Lords to vassals. Kingship he retained for himself. There would be no kings in Westeros but Aegon. House Tully. The Tullys of River Run were never kings, though the books of lineages will show any number of connections to the dynasties of the past. It may have been these old connections that started House Tully on its path to becoming Lords Paramount of the Trident under Aegon I. Tully names appear in many chronicles and annals of the Trident, back onto the days of the First Men, when the first Edmure Tully and his sons fought beside the Hammer of Justice, Tristfer the Fourth Mud, in many of his 99 victories. After Tristfer's death, Sir Edmure went over to the mightiest of the Andal conquerors, Armistead Vance. It was from him that Edmure's son, Axel, received a grant of lands at the juncture of the Red Fork and its swift-running vassal, the Tomberstone. There Lord Axel established his seat in a red castle he named River Run. Placed as it was, River Run soon proved to have great strategic value, and the petty kings contending during the Age of Anarchy soon began to vie for the support of House Tully. Axel and his descendants grew wealthy and powerful, and in time became the bulwark of many a river king, for they defended the Trident's western marches against the Kingdom of the Rock. The Tullys were accounted amongst the foremost lords of the Riverlands by the time that the Storm Kings won their final war against the last king of the rivers and hills. Some noble houses were destroyed in those wars, but most bent the knee to the Storm Kings once the Teagues were dispossessed, and the Tullys were amongst them. Soon Tullys began to appear in prominent offices and trusted positions. River Run weathered the reigns of the Storm Kings and survived the subsequent Ironborn conquest largely intact. Other powerful houses of the Riverlands were not so fortunate. A decade before Aegon's conquest, the Blackwoods and Brackens had entered into a new private war in their ancient feud. Previously, their Arnborn overlords had largely ignored such conflicts amongst their vassals. Indeed, if the Iron Chronicle can be believed, Harwin Hardhand oft seemed to pit his bannermen against one another to keep them weak. But this time the feuding disrupted the construction of Harrenhal, and that was enough reason for Heron the Black to deal with them harshly. So it was that when Aegon the Conqueror marched upon Harrenhal, the Tullys of Riverrun were the most powerful of river lords still remaining. 40 years of Black Heron's rule, which brought penury and the deaths of thousands, had won him no love in the Riverlands. Consequently, Aegon's arrival was heralded by lords great and small, flocking to his banner, keen to overthrow their cruel foreign king, and chief among them was Edmund Tully. When Harrenhal burned and Harren the Black's line was ended, Aegon gave the rule of the Riverlands to Lord Edmund. Some even proposed that Lord Tully be granted dominion over the Iron Islands as well, though that did not come to pass. Lord Edmund did much to repair the damage that Harren had left behind him. New ties were forged, as when the new-made Lord Quentin Coherus, once master-at-arms at Dragonstone, and by then lord of ruined Harrenhal and its sizable lands, took Lord Tully's daughter to wife, though in later years this would prove a troublesome connection, alleviated only by the swift sad end of House Coherus. It was in 7 AC as well that Lord Edmund began his 2 years as Hand of the King, ending when he resigned the office and returned to Riverrun and his family. In the years to come, men of House Tully would play a role in many of the chief events of the early Targaryen kings. When King Aenys I guested at Riverrun, and Harren the Red slew Gargon the Guest, it was to the Tullys and their bannermen that his grace turned to try to wrest Harrenhal away from the outlaw king. In later years, the Tullys, together with the Harroways, who at that time ruled Harrenhal, fielded part of the army that surrounded and defeated Prince Aegon and his dragon, Quicksilver, in his war against his uncle, Maegor the Cruel.
Herewith a list of houses that have, at one time or another, ruled the Riverlands, as asserted in the histories. House Fisher of the Misty Isle. House Blackwood of Raventree. House Bracken of Stone Hedge. House Mud of Oldstones, last dynasty of the first men to rule the Riverlands. House Justman. House Teague, last of the kings of the rivers and hills native to the Riverlands. House Durrandon of Storm's End. House Hoare of the Iron Islands. The feud of the Blackwoods and Brackens is infamous, and rightly so, for it stretches back thousands of years to before the coming of the Andals. The origins of it are contested and shrouded in legend. The Blackwoods say they were kings, and the Brackens little more than petty lords set on betraying and deposing them, while the Brackens say much the same about the Blackwoods. That they were both royal houses on the Trident seems true enough, and none can doubt that their enmity sprang from some cause, so entrenched that it has become legendary. Powerful as they were, they have maintained their feud despite the many kings who have attempted to make a peace between them. Even the old king, Jaehaerys the Conciliator, failed in his attempt to halt this ceaseless war, for the peace he forged did not long outlast the end of his reign. The Lords of Harrenhal. Lord Gargon, the second and last Coherus Lord of Harrenhal, was the grandson of Lord Quentin. He was notorious for his appetite for women, and became known as the Guest, for his habit of attending every wedding within his domains, so that he might take advantage of the Lord's right to the first night. It is no surprise that the father of a maid Lord Gargon deflowered opened a sally port for Harren the Red and his band of outlaws, or that Gargan was gelded before he died. Harrenhal would earn a reputation as cursed in the years that followed, as many of its ruling houses would meet unhappy ends. House Harroway, raised to Harrenhal in the reign of Aenys I, following the death of Gargan Coherus, Lord Lucas Harroway saw his daughter Alice wed to Maegor. She became one of Maegor's queens, and he became Hand, until Maegor the Cruel had them and all their line killed. House Towers. After destroying House Harroway, King Maegor decreed that the strongest of his knights would have the castle, though not all of its lands. 23 knights of his household fought in the blood-soaked streets of Lord Harroway's town for the prize. Sir Walton Towers was the victor, and was granted the seat, though he died soon thereafter of his wounds. His line faltered 2 generations later, when the last Lord Towers died without heirs. House Strong. Lionel Strong, famed as a warrior but also a man of great natural gifts who had earned 6 links in his chain at the Citadel, was granted the lordship in the reign of Jaehaerys I. He served as Master of Laws, then Hand to Viserys I, while his sons became deeply entangled in the court. He and his heir, Sir Harwin, were killed in a fire that broke out in Harrenhal, leaving the younger son, Laerys Strong, to become Lord of Harrenhal. Laerys survived the Dance of the Dragons, but not the Judgment of the Wolf. House Lothston. Sir Lucas Lothston, Master-at-Arms at the Red Keep, was given the seat as a gift from King Aegon III in 151 AC. Newly wed to the Lady Philaena Stokeworth, following the scandal of her relations with Prince Aegon, the future Aegon the Unworthy, Lothston soon departed court with his bride. He returned to King's Landing in Aegon's reign, serving as Hand for less than a year before Aegon again banished him from court along with his wife and daughter. Their line was ended in madness and chaos when Lady Danelle Lothston turned to the black arts during the reign of King Maker I. House Went. Knights in the service of the Lothstons, they were given Harrenhal as a reward for their service in bringing the Lothstons down. They hold the seat to this day, but tragedy has marked them. It was during the early days of the dance that Prince Daemon Targaryen led Queen Rhaenyra's forces to a bloodless victory at Harrenhal, seizing the castle and making it a rallying place for her supporters. There were many such supporters in the Riverlands, who rose in their thousands and joined the prince's host in Rhaenyra's name. Notable amongst them was the puissant knight, Lord Forrest Frey, who had once been a suitor for Rhaenyra's hand. The Freys were not an old house. They had risen to prominence some 600 years ago, their line originating from a petty lord who raised a rickety wooden bridge across the narrowest part of the Green Fork. But as their wealth and influence grew, so did the crossing. And soon the castle grew from a single tower that overlooked the bridge to 2 formidable towers that bracketed the river between them. These 2 keeps, now called the Twins, are amongst the strongest in the realm. Lord Forrest fought gallantly for the queen he had loved, until the fish feed, where he was amongst many lords and knights killed in the war's bloodiest battle. His widow, the Lady Sabatha of House Viperyn, proved redoubtable for her courage and notorious for her lack of mercy. According to Mushroom, she was a sharp-featured, sharp-tongued harridan of House Viperyn, who would sooner ride than dance, wore mail instead of silk, and was fond of killing men and kissing women.
But it was not long before Riverrun too began to chafe beneath King Maegor's heel. As his enemies rose around him, the Tullys rallied to the banners of Prince Jaehaerys Targaryen, brother of the slain Prince Aegon, in the final year of his cruel uncle's reign. Through the years that followed, the Tullys continued to leave their mark on history. Lord Grover Tully spoke for Prince Viserys Targaryen over Laenor Velaryon as the successor to Jaehaerys I in the Great Council of 101 AC. When the Dance of the Dragons erupted in 129 AC, the old lord proved loyal to his principals and King Aegon II. But he was aged then and bedridden, and his grandson, Sir Elmo, defied him and had the gates barred and the banners kept close. Later, during the dance, Sir Elmo Tully led the River Lords into battle at Second Tumbleton, but on the side of Queen Rhaenyra rather than King Aegon II, whom his grandsire had favoured. The battle proved a victory, at least in part, and soon after his grandfather finally died, and Sir Elmo became Lord of Riverrun. But he did not long enjoy his station. He died on the march 49 days later, leaving his young son, Sir Kermit, to succeed him. Lord Kermit brought the Tullys to the height of their power. Vital and bold, he fought tirelessly for Queen Rhaenyra and her son, Prince Aegon, later King Aegon III. Lord Kermit was the chief commander of the host that descended on King's Landing in the last days of the war, and he personally slew Lord Boris Baratheon in the final battle of the Dance of the Dragons. His successors ruled as best they could after him, but River Run was never again as prominent as during those years. Loyal to House Targaryen through all the Blackfyre rebellions, House Tully finally soured on the Dragon Kings during the madness of King Aerys II Targaryen, and Lord Huster Tully joined Robert Baratheon and his rebels and helped bind together the alliance that brought Robert to the Iron Throne by granting the hands of his daughters to Lord John Arryn of the Eyrie and Lord Eddard Stark of Winterfell. Riverrun. The seat of House Tully is small when compared to the great fortress castles of other great houses. It is not even the largest castle in the Riverlands, for Harren the Black's ruined immensity of Harrenhal could contain 10 River Runs. Yet River Run is stout and well constructed, and its position at the juncture of two rivers, surrounded by deep waters on two sides, makes it exceedingly difficult to assault. Though besieged many times over the centuries, River Run has seldom been taken, and never by storm. Key to the castle's strength is the moat dug beneath its western wall, where the main gate stands. Many castles in the Seven Kingdoms have moats, but few are created with complicated sluice gates that allow them to be flooded at need. This gives River Run's moat a depth and breadth few others can achieve. With its moat fully flooded, River Run becomes an island, all but invulnerable to assault. The Vale. The Vale of Arryn, a long, wide, fertile valley, entirely ringed by the great grey-green peaks of the mighty Mountains of the Moon, is as rich as it is beautiful. Perhaps that was why the first Andal invaders chose to land there when they crossed the narrow sea beneath the banners of their gods. The proof of that claim lies in the stones carved all about the fingers, which bear images of stars, swords, and axes, or hammers, as some have argued. The sacred book of the faith, the seven-pointed star, speaks of a golden land amidst towering mountains. When Hugo of the Hill received his vision of the bounty that would one day belong to the Andals. Isolated from the rest of Westeros by its towering mountains, the Vale proved the perfect ground for the Andals to carve out the first kingdoms in this new land. The first men who were there before the Andals fought these seaborne conquerors stubbornly, but the Vale was but thinly peopled in those days, and they soon found themselves outnumbered in every fight. No sooner was one longship set aflame or driven back into the sea, the singers say, then 10 more rose from the dawn. Nor could the first men match the zeal of the invaders, and their bronze axes and burnies of bronze scales prove less than equal to the steel swords and iron ringmail of the Andals. Moreover, the vale and its surrounding peaks were divided into a score of petty kingdoms when the first Andals began wading ashore. With a seven-pointed star painted, or carved in some cases, on their chests. Riven by ancient enmities, the kings of the first men did not unite against the invaders when first they appeared, but rather made pacts and alliances with them, seeking to use the newcomers in their wars against one another. A familiar folly that was to be repeated time and time again, as the Andals spread out across Westeros. Darwin Shell and John Brightstone, both of whom claimed the title King of the Fingers, went so far as to pay Andal warlords to cross the sea, each thinking to use their swords against the other. Instead, the warlords turned upon their hosts. Within a year, Brightstone had been taken, tortured, and beheaded, and Shell roasted alive inside his wooden long hall. An Andal knight named Corwin Corbray took the daughter of the former for his bride, and the wife of the latter for his bedwarmer, and claimed the fingers for his own, though Corbray, unlike many of his fellows, never named himself a king, preferring the more modest style of Lord of the Five Fingers. Farther south, the wealthy harbour town of Gulltown, on the Bay of Crabs, was ruled by Osgood Shett, third of his name, a grizzled old warrior who claimed the ancient, vainglorious title King of the True Men, a style that supposedly went back 10,000 years to the Dawn Age. Though Gulltown itself was seemingly secure behind its thick stone walls, King Osgood and his forebears had long been waging an intermittent war against the Bronze Kings of Runestone. A more powerful neighbour from a house as old and storied as their own. Yorick Royce, sixth of that name, had claimed the runic crown when his sire died in battle 3 years previous, and had proved to be a most redoubtable foe, defeating the Shetts in several battles and driving them back inside their town walls. Unwisely, King Osgood turned to Andalus for help in recovering all he had lost. Thinking to avoid the fate of Shell and Brightstone, he sought to bind his allies to him with blood in place of gold. He gave his daughter in marriage to the Andal knight Gerald Grafton, took Sir Gerald's eldest daughter for his own bride, and married a younger daughter to his son and heir. All the marriages were performed by septons, according to the rites of the Seven from across the sea. Shett even went so far as to convert to the faith himself, swearing to build a great sept in Gulltown should the Seven grant him victory. Then he sallied forth with his Andal allies to meet the Bronze King. King Osgood won his victory, as it happened, but he himself did not survive the battle, and afterwards it was whispered amongst the Gulltowners and other first men that it was Sir Gerald himself who struck him down. Upon his return to the town, the Andal warlord claimed his good father's crown for his own, dispossessing the younger Shett and confining him to his bedchamber until such time as he had gotten Sir Gerald's daughter with child, after which the father vanishes from the pages of history. When Gulltown rose against him, King Gerald put down the protest brutally, and soon the gutters of the town ran red with the blood of the first men, and women and children as well. The dead were thrown in the bay to feed the crabs. In the years that followed, the rule of House Grafton remained uncontested, for, surprisingly, Sir Gerald proved a sage and clever ruler, and the town prospered greatly under him and his successors, growing to be the first and only city of the Vale. Not all the lords and kings of the first men were so foolish as to invite their conquerors into their halls and homes. Many chose to fight instead. Chief amongst these was the aforementioned Bronze King, Yorick VI of Runestone, who led the Royces to several notable victories over the Andals, at one point smashing 7 longships that had dared to land upon his shores, and decorating the walls of Runestone with the heads of their captains and crews. His heirs carried on the fight after him, for the wars between the First Men and the Andals lasted for generations. The last of the Bronze Kings was Yorick's grandson, Robar II, who inherited Runestone from his sire less than a fortnight before his 16th name day, yet proved to be a warrior of such ferocity and cunning and charm that he almost succeeded in stemming the Andal tide. By that time the Andals controlled 3/4 of the Vale, and had begun to fight amongst themselves, as had the First Men before them. Robar Royce saw opportunity in their disunity. Across the Vale, a handful of First Men still held out against the Andals, the Red Forts of Redfort, the Hunters of Longbow Hall, the Belmores of Strong Song, and the Coldwaters of Coldwater Burn, chief amongst them. One by one, Robar made alliance with each of them, and many smaller clans and houses besides, bringing them to his cause with marriages, grants of land, gold, and in one celebrated case, by outshooting the Lord Hunter in an archery contest. Legend claims that King Robar cheated. So honeyed was his tongue that he even won the allegiance of Ursula Upcliffe, a reputed sorceress who called herself Bride of the Merlin King. Many of the lords who gathered beneath his banners had been petty kings, but now they set aside their crowns, bending the knee before Robar Royce, and proclaiming him High King of the Vale, the Fingers, and the Mountains of the Moon. Finally united as one people under a single ruler, the First Men went on to win a series of smashing victories against their divided, quarrelsome conquerors. Wisely, King Robar did not attempt to attack all Andals everywhere to drive them from his shores. Instead, he warred upon one enemy at a time, often making common cause with one Andal chief to bring down another. The King of the Fingers was first to fall. Legend tells us that King Robar slew Kyle Corbray himself, after striking Corbray's famous blade, Lady Forlorn, from his hand. Galtown was retaken by storm when Robar sent his own sister inside the walls to persuade the Shetts to rise against the Graftons and open the city gates. The Hammer of the Hills, the Andal king who held the eastern end of the Vale, was next to face the resurgent First Men and fell before King Robar's hosts beneath the walls of Iron Oaks. For one brief shining moment, it appeared as if the First Men might yet retake their lands under the leadership of this brave young king. But it was not to be. Robar had won his last victory, for the remaining Andal lords and petty kings had finally come to realize their peril. And now it was the Andals who put aside their differences to make common cause and unite beneath the banners of a single warlord. The man they chose to lead them was neither king nor prince, nor even lord, but a knight named Sir Artis Erin. A young man, of an age with King Robar, he was esteemed amongst his peers as the finest warrior of his day, a champion with sword and lance and morning star, and a cunning and resourceful leader of men, beloved by all who fought beside him. Though of pure Andal blood, Sir Artis had been born in the Vale in the shadow of the Giant's Lance, where falcons soared amongst the mountain's jagged peaks. On his shield he bore the moon and falcon, whilst a pair of falcon's wings decorated his silver war helm. The Falcon Knight, men called him, then as now. To speak of what happened next, we must return to the realm of song and legend. The singers say the two hosts came together at the foot of the giant's lance, within a league of the house where Sir Artes had been born. Though the armies were roughly equal in number, Robar Royce held the high ground, with a mountain at his back, a strong defensive position. Having arrived days before the Andals, the first men had dug trenches in front of their ranks and lined them with sharpened stakes, smeared with offal and excrement, says Septon Mallow's account of the battle. Most of the first men were afoot. The Andals had a 10-to-1 advantage in mountain knights and were better armed and armoured as well. They came late to the battle, if the tales are true. King Robar had looked for them 3 days earlier and every day since. It was dusk when the Andal army finally appeared, to raise their tents half a league from their foes. But even in that fading light, Robar Royce did not fail to mark their leader. His silvered armour and winged helm made the Falcon Knight unmistakable, even from afar. No doubt the night that followed was a restless one in both camps, for every man there knew that battle would be joined at the break of day, with the veil itself hanging in the balance. Clouds blew in from the east, hiding the moon and stars, so the night was dark indeed. The only light came from hundreds of campfires burning in the camps, with a river of darkness between them. From time to time, the singers say, archers on one side or another lofted an arrow in the air, hoping that it might find a foe. But whether any of the blind shafts drew blood, the tales do not tell. As east began to lighten, men rose from their stony beds, donned their armour, and prepared for the battle. Then a shout rang through the Andal camp. There to the west, a sign had been seen. 7 stars, gleaming in the grey dawn sky. "The gods are with us," went up the cry from 1,000 throats. "Victory is ours!" As trumpets blew, the vanguard of the Andals charged up the slope, banners streaming. Yet the first men showed no dismay at the sign that had appeared in the sky. They held their ground, and battle was joined, as savage and bloody a fight as any in the long history of the Vale. 7 times the Andals charged, the singers say. 6 times the first men threw them back. But the 7th attack, led by a fearsome giant of a man named Torgol Tollet, broke through. Torgol the Grim, this man was called. But even his name was a jape, for it is written that he went into battle laughing, naked above the waist, with a bloody 7-pointed star carved across his chest, and an axe in each hand. The songs say that Torgol knew no fear and felt no pain. Though bleeding from 10 wounds, he cut a red swathe through Lord Redfort's staunchest warriors, then took his lordship's arm off at the shoulder with a single cut. Nor was he dismayed when the sorceress, Ursula Upcliffe, appeared upon a blood-red horse to curse him. By then he was barehanded, having left both of his axes buried in a foe's chest. But the singers say he leapt upon the witch's horse, grasped her face between 2 bloody hands, and tore her head from her shoulders as she screamed for succor. Then chaos ensued as the Andals came pouring through the gap in the ranks of the first men. Victory seemed within their grasp, but Robar Royce was not so easily defeated. Where another man might have fallen back to regroup or fled the field, the High King commanded a counterattack. He led the charge himself, smashing through the confusion with his champions by his side. In his hand was Lady Forlorn, that dread blade he had plucked from the dead hands of the King of the Fingers. Slaying men right and left, the king fought his way to Torgol the Grim. As Robar slashed at his head, Tollet grabbed for his blade, still laughing. But Lady Forlorn sliced through his hands and buried herself in Torgol's skull. The giant died choking on his last laugh, the singer said, whereupon the High King spied the Falcon Knight across the field and spurred toward him. Should their leader fall, the Andals would lose heart and break, he hoped. They came together as the battle raged around them, the king in bronze armor, the hero in silvered steel. Though the Falcon Knight's armor flashed brilliantly in the morning sun, his sword was no Lady Forlorn. The duel was done almost before it began, as the blade sheared through the winged helm and laid the Andal low. For an instant, as his foe toppled from the saddle, Robar Royce must surely have thought his battle won. Then he heard the trumpets ringing through the dawn air, the sound coming from behind him, and turning in his saddle, the High King beheld in dismay 500 fresh Andal knights pouring down the slopes of the giant's lance to take his own host in the rear. Leading the attack was a champion in silvered steel, with a moon and falcon on his shield and wings upon his war helm. Sir Arti's errand had clad one of his knight's retainer in his spare suit of armor, leaving him in camp whilst he himself took his best horseman up and around a goat track that he remembered from his childhood, so they might reappear behind the first men and descend on them from above. The rest was a rout. Attacked from front and rear, the last great host of the first men of the Vale was cut to pieces. 30 lords had come to fight for Robar Royce that day. Not a one survived. And though the singers say the High King slew foes by the score, in the end he too was slain. Some say Sir Arti's killed him, while others name Lord Ruthermont, or Lucian Templeton, the Knight of Nine Stars. The Corbrays of Hart's Home have always insisted that it was Sir Jaime Corbray who dealt the mortal blow, and for proof they point to Lady Forlorn, reclaimed for House Corbray after the battle. Such is the tale of the Battle of the Seven Stars, as it is told by singers and the Septons. A stirring story, to be sure, but the scholar must ask how much of it is true. We shall never know. All that is certain is that King Robar II of House Royce met Sir Arti's Erin in a great battle at the foot of the giant's lance, where the king died and the Falcon Knight dealt the first men a blow from which they never recovered. No fewer than 14 of the oldest and noblest houses of the Vale ended that day. Those whose lines endured, the Red Forts, the Hunters, the Coldwaters, the Belmores, and the Royces themselves amongst them, did so only by the dint of yielding up gold and land and hostages to their conquerors, and bending their knees to swear fealty to Arti's Erin, the first of his name, new crowned King of Mountain and Vale. In time, some of these fallen houses would regain much of the pride and wealth and power lost on the battlefield that day, but that would require the passage of centuries. As for the victors, the Aerons would rule the Vale as kings until the coming of Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters, and thereafter served as the lords of the Eyrie, protectors of the Vale, and wardens of the East. And from that day forth, the Vale itself has been known as the Vale of Erin. The fate of the defeated was far crueler. As word of the victory spread across the narrow sea, more and more longships set sail for Mandalus, and more Andals poured into the Vale and the surrounding mountains. All of them required land, land the Andal lords were pleased to give them. Wherever the first men sought to resist, they were ground underfoot, reduced to thralls, or driven out. Their own lords, beaten, were powerless to protect them. Some of the first men surely survived by joining their own blood with that of the Andals, but many more fled westward to the high valleys and stony passes of the Mountains of the Moon. There, the descendants of this once